Welcome to this month's episode of the Medicinal Herbs Podcast from Holistic Matters. This month, our host, Dana Parent, is talking with naturopath, herbalist, and acupuncturist Lawrence Katsaris about the four herbs he says are absolutely vital in clinical practice. We're talking about echinacea, astragalus, ashwagandha, and St. John's wort. What is it these herbs have in common? Their applications are broad and their medicinal effects are potent.
Hello, and welcome to the Medicinal Herbs Podcast from Holistic Matters. I'm your host, Dr. Dana Parent, and this month we are bringing back Lawrence Katsaris, who is a naturopath, herbalist, acupuncturist, and an experienced educator in functional medicine in Australia and New Zealand for over 15 years. Lawrence, welcome back, and thanks for joining us again on the podcast.
Thanks for having me back, Dana. It's great to be here.
And so, Lawrence, let's get started. What are these common herbs that you wanted to share with us, and what are their clinical applications?
Yes, there's a few herbs that I love to be making sure that I have always stocked in my medicinary, because I just find that they are so relevant for so many patients across the board. So there's a few lists, but for time, we can narrow it down to four, I think, today. Echinacea, ashwagandha, St. John's wort. And these are particularly herbs that I think have a broad spectrum beyond just where we might think about them. And I'll talk about what I mean there in terms of we probably have applications where we might use those herbs, such as echinacea and immunity, and ashwagandha for the nervous system, St. John's wort for, you know, the nervous system and mood. And also astragalus, as you like to call it over there, as a herb that is also provides such a broad action in so many patients that I just find I continue to reach for these herbs when I'm seeing patients across the board for a variety of different presentations.
And I'd like to start off with echinacea. And I really love your idea of really not categorizing these and just putting them into this box where we just think about them for one indication or one clinical use. So with echinacea, for instance, you know, I was taught in my formal training that really, you know, echinacea is good for immune system support. But as I understand and research and, you know, these clinical applications really span far beyond just the immune system. So can you explain how this works and when it might be appropriate to use echinacea?
Yeah, definitely. I think that that's a really good point, Dana, is that as herbalists, we can sometimes start to think of and typecast our herbs in particular ways, and we start to get comfortable with just using them for particular conditions. And I think it's really important to continue to stretch our knowledge to make sure that we understand how the herbs are working, because essentially the beauty of Mother Nature and the beauty of how herbs work is that they're going in and they're sort of tickling different pathways and they're stimulating and supporting other pathways within the body and essentially balancing up a bit of a network, what's now kind of been called in Western science, a networked pharmacology, where it has a broad action on multiple different pathways. So with something like echinacea, sure, it's always been thought of, I mean, it even kind of gets dubbed as a bit of an immune stimulant, and we can talk about how it's actually more of an immune modulator. But the way that echinacea is working is that it contains the active constituents known as alkylamides. Now, these alkylamides are responsible for immune modulating actions. And what they actually do is they'll help to produce responses within the immune system to be helping to, you know, increase our immune response. It might be activating natural killer cells. It might be helping with reducing inflammatory cytokines. These alkylamides actually are what producing the benefits to the white blood cells and the benefits to the immune system to actually create a broad spectrum effect. And interestingly, they've shown in studies that it works to stimulate an immune cell when that immune cell has a trigger or a challenge. So without an immunological challenge, the immune cell isn't just stimulated off the bat, which tends to be the case with a lot of immune herbs when we're using them, is they tend to be more modulators. But echinacea definitely is a modulator. Without the presence of any kind of viral bacterial stimulation, it's not going to just ramp up our white blood cell activity. It's not going to send our natural killer cells through the roof. It will only do that when the body needs to respond to a particular infection. Now, I mentioned these alkylamides as the active constituents which are helping to do that. And you can tell the presence of alkylamides because if you're having a tincture or an extract, it gives this tingling sensation on the tongue. And those of us that have ever taken echinacea will kind of be familiar with this. And it was a way that was actually used to be recognizing the potency of the herb traditionally, is that you'd pick the root and you could kind of chew the root and you could taste these alkylamides and you get the tingling sensation of the on the tongue. Now, there's different forms of these alkylamides, and there's different species of echinacea, and the two common species that are mostly used therapeutically because they contain the highest amounts of alkylamides is Echinacea angustifolia and Echinacea purpurea. Now, there's an alkylamide called 2,4-diene, and this is present in both Echinacea angustifolia and Echinacea purpurea. Now, the reason why this is important is I'm not just kind of boring the audience with chemistry, is it's actually these 2,4-diene alkylamides are actually fast-acting. So they go into the body and they produce an immune response and an anti-inflammatory response, and they work quickly, but they're also rapidly metabolized and broken down by the liver quickly. So essentially, they produce a short-lived activity within the body. Now, interestingly, in Echinacea angustifolia, in that species of Echinacea, it actually contains the alkylamide 2-ene, so different to the 2,4-diene. Now, this 2-ene alkylamide is actually slowly metabolized and slower than 2,4-diene, and it can produce a bit more of a delayed therapeutic response, so it might be slower to act, but because it's slower to break down, it basically produces a prolonged immune modulating activity. So you can probably start to get a sense of where I'm going here, is that if you take like something like Echinacea purpurea, it has the 2,4-diene alkylamide, it has a quick potent activity, but it's also metabolized quickly. So within, you know, an hour to 2 hours, it's finished. You don't have any left in your system, so you'd need to be dosing that repeatedly through the day. However, the angustifolia has more of a delayed activity. And interestingly, the angustifolia containing the 2-ene alkylamide slows down the metabolism of the 2,4-diene. So what happens is when you combine Echinacea angustifolia with Echinacea purpurea, you start to prolong the therapeutic activity of Echinacea because you're providing a slower metabolism of the active constituents. So the ways in which you use Echinacea is also dependent upon the species that you're using, essentially, is what I'm saying. Because if you're using this as an immune modulating activity, and it's for someone who's maybe got a current infection or is acutely sick or is a chronic immune compromise, you want that prolonged activity through the day because it's not realistic that people are going to be dosing every couple of hours. So then you start to combine the combination of those Echinacea species, angustifolia and purpurea, and you get that prolonged immune modulation effect.
Yeah, and that makes a lot of sense, you know, combining these two species, the Echinacea angustifolia and the Echinacea purpurea. And so really what I'm hearing is that ideally you would want a combination of these two species of Echinacea. You may want to consider a product that has both of them as they act synergistically with one another. Is that correct?
Exactly. You're going to get more bang for your buck, basically. It's going to work longer within the individual, and you're wanting to be making sure that you're using those two species as well, because they are the highest in alkylamides compared to other species.
And that makes sense. Also, I wanted to go back to something that you had mentioned, and it specifically relates to Echinacea as immune stimulating, because that's what I have... that's what I'm really familiar with. And so what does this mean for duration? Are you saying that you can be on Echinacea for long-term duration as well?
Yeah, exactly, Dana. It is safe to be using long term. Now, it's a bit of a misconception that echinacea is an immune stimulator and that you should only use it short term. It's not how the herb works. It works to modulate immune activity. And as I mentioned, studies have shown that without the presence of any immunological challenge, it doesn't stimulate the immune system. You can think about it more like, I guess from a herbal actions perspective, it is an immune modulator, but you can sort of think about it as the fact that it primes the body, it primes the immune system to have everything it needs to be responsive if required. But if it is not required, it will not go and initiate an immune response. So it's safe to use long-term, and there's studies to demonstrate this, and also from clinical use. I mean, Professor Kerry Bone, who is like the herbal authority in the world on echinacea, I would say without any question, has been using echinacea every day for the majority of his life. It's, you know, it actions work as an immune modulator, and Professor Bone has even been showing that essentially you can probably think about echinacea as more as an adaptogen as well. Like it helps the body adapt to stressors, and it helps the body through doing part of this is to be priming that immune system to be working if required. So there is absolutely no problem using echinacea long-term. That applies for, you know, I'll often use it for someone who might have recurrent infections. So echinacea would be relevant at the time that they may present if they've got an infection. So it might be, you know, an upper respiratory infection. And I could probably talk about which infections it works best for in a moment. But I will use it when someone is sick, but then we'll continue to use it if that person is a little bit immune compromised. You know, the person that's a bit run down, they continue to get sick, and it stays in the formula. I might be using a product with it for 3 months, 6 months, easy. Like I've used it in individuals who are severely immune compromised in the cases of things such as cancer for long term, you know, 12 months or more. So I guess the devil is always in the detail, and it's important in understanding how it is that echinacea primes the immune system. And essentially what it's doing is it's priming our white blood cells to respond when they see an immune challenge. If there is no immune challenge, they're not going in there, tapping the white blood cells on the shoulder and pushing them to do anything. So really, it's an immune modulator. It's working to do that, and it's safe to do that acutely right through to long-term and continue to take it long-term if required.
And if you don't mind me asking, what are those infections or indications that you find, you know, echinacea to be, you know, the best at supporting or the best at treating?
Yeah, it's a really important point. So it's been shown to be beneficial for, because of the immune modulating activity, anything where someone has a need for immune support, echinacea is going to be beneficial. So that could be anything from skin infections right through to, you know, like ulcerations through to respiratory infections. But acute and chronic respiratory infections is certainly where echinacea shines. But across the board, any viral bacterial infections, echinacea is always in there. And, you know, like I mentioned astragalus, and it's a herb that we can talk about soon. That's a combination that I'm putting in echinacea and astragalus or astragalus for anyone who's got recurrent infections and lowered immunity. But certainly for respiratory infections, echinacea does really well. But keep in mind that it's more than just an immune modulator as well. It also has general anti-inflammatory actions. It's a lymphatic, it has vulnerary actions. And so because of that, I find it does very well for skin infections as well. So it's often a herb of choice that I'll be adding in for acne rosacea, because you're getting the localized infections on the skin. And because of its lymphatic actions, it helps them move things through. So certainly respiratory infections, skin infections, but probably because they're the most common, but any infection across the board, bacterial, viral, echinacea will do well.
And what about autoimmune conditions? Because this is another area that I was taught, again, in some formal training, to never use echinacea in autoimmune conditions. So what is your take, and what does the research say about that?
Really good question. So just the same as I guess we were saying before, it's an immune modulator. Now, that sounds nice in theory, but in the proof within the research is echinacea has been shown to be beneficial in autoimmune conditions. And there's a plethora of studies that are demonstrating this now, is that they're regulating T cell differentiation. And if we think about what's happening in autoimmunity, we have a variety of our T cells as a branch of our immune system, which are becoming overactive. You know, this may be, you know, depending upon the condition, this may be T helper 1 cells or T helper 17, T helper 27, 21. Now, these cells becoming far too active is then what's driving the tissue destruction and the inflammation. Now, what echinacea is doing is it's helping with differentiation of your naive T cells, or otherwise known as your T0 cells, which will branch into within the immune system. They'll develop into T regulatory cells, and the T regulatory cells are often thought of as like the managers of the whole immune cell army, if you think of it that way. And that the T regulatory cells then help dictate which cells will be deployed and will be active. And what we see in autoimmunity is there's a decrease in T regulatory cells because too many cells are getting told to grow up and become a particular T helper cell, which is overactive in immunity. So in something like rheumatoid arthritis, for instance, you've got a high amount of T helper 17 and a high amount of T helper 1 cell, amongst others, and you don't have enough T regulatory cells. What echinacea is doing is it's helping with the naive T cells to become more T regulatory cells instead of becoming T helper 1 cells. By nature of that is that you've got more managers, more T regulatory cells, to start to have a look and say, hey, we need to pull back. We've got a lot of T helper 1 and T helper 17. We need to regulate these back. It's causing a lot of tissue destruction. So in short, echinacea helps to moderate the overactivity that's taking place on a white blood cell level in autoimmunity. Therefore, decreasing what's actually driving that inflammation. And again, this is where I say the devil is in the detail, because understanding that that's how it drives an immune response is then why we can see that it's relevant as an immune modulator. Because in the opposite of that situation, if someone who comes in who's immune compromised and who's sick and suffering from a viral infection or a bacterial infection, let's just say they've got a respiratory infection, what's happening is they don't have enough of the T helper cells to mount an immune response. Echinacea is coming in and it's sort of waking that up and getting it moving. The same process is it's doing is it's coming in, it's regulating, it's modulating what's happening in that white blood cell activity. So because of that, it's beneficial in autoimmunity. It is my go-to. That alongside hemidesmus is my go-to in autoimmune conditions, because hemidesmus does a good job on kind of down-regulating an overactive immune system and is anti-inflammatory. Echinacea comes in to help modulate and almost make that immune system a little bit more intelligent and start to be aware of where it's being overactive. And then you've got the anti-inflammatory actions of echinacea there as well. So safe to use in autoimmunity. And I'm really glad you asked that question, because it again is another misconception. Just the same as, you know, if we even wanted to go to the extreme level of, you know, we look at particular cancers where there's overactivity of white blood cells. Echinacea has been shown to be beneficial in there as well, because it's regulating it from a cell line perspective, regulating the activity that's taking place, the imbalance there. So safe to use in autoimmunity, safe to use long-term. Basically, wherever there is anything of the immune system being off balance, is it overactive? Is it underactive? Echinacea will help to restore that balance.
Wow, that is a lot of information about echinacea. And thank you so much for that summary, because that really helps put it into perspective. I clearly have much more to learn, and I'm excited about doing so. But I do want to move on to our next herb, which is astragalus. And you mentioned this one previously. And we, you know, I think as naturopaths and as herbalists, we're pretty familiar with this herb in supporting the immune system. So can you talk about this one specifically? And now that I know I can use echinacea long term, can I use these two herbs together?
Definitely. And that's where I would rarely use astragalus without echinacea, to be honest, Dana, because the majority of times where I'm using the herb is in that individual where they've got immune compromise, that person that's got lowered immunity, they've got recurrent colds and flus, they may have been suffering with an infection long term, or that post-viral fatigue, you know, that dragging out, I've never been well since I had that infection. They're in that constant state of, you know, convalescence. Astragalus is perfect there, and because it's got those adaptogenic effects and it's got that immune supportive effects. So what better herb to combine that with than, of course, you know, the king of the immune herbs is echinacea. So I'm often putting echinacea and astragalus together for that patient that I've just described, that chronic, low-grade immune thing that's just dragging on. And the two of them really sing when you put them together. People start to notice results within sort of 2-4 weeks. You know, people that have been that post-viral fatigue, the rundown, the recurrent infections, they'll start to notice in 2 weeks that those infections are clearing up, they're feeling better, they've got more energy, et cetera.
And I understand there's a couple of different perspectives. There's this traditional perspective and maybe a Western perspective about astragalus as well. Is that something that you can talk to us about?
Yeah, definitely. So astragalus is a traditional Chinese herb. So it's like been used for thousands of years in Chinese medicine. And the way that Chinese medicine views the body is slightly different. Some of it matches up and some of it is a bit of a different paradigm. But essentially, where we can see the commonalities, probably to help break it down to non-Chinese medicine practitioners, is astragalus is used to tonify qi. Now, it's an interesting and huge topic in itself to discuss and try and define. You can think it gets dubbed as like, you know, the energy of the body and the vitality of the body. I kind of also think about it as like the innate information within the body. And it helps the body transform and, you know, on a perspective of health and, you know, psychologically and many other different levels. Now, astragalus is used to tonify this qi, and it does this alongside tonifying blood. Chinese medicine, the qi and the blood are like two vital substances which are helping us to flourish. Now, astragalus does this by also supporting the spleen. And in Western terms, you can think about the spleen probably collectively more as like the digestive system. And it's the main organ from a Chinese medicine perspective or system that's actually important in supporting production of qi. Now, we see this from a Western perspective, which is very much we eat food, the digestion goes in, it digests, like it goes into the digestive system that extracts the nutrients from that food, and that helps to, you know, extract our vitamins and minerals, and we help to build energy from that. Chinese medicine see it in a similar way, and they see that the spleen in this case extracts the qi from the food and it helps to build qi, and that qi gets used to build the blood as a bit of a crash course in Chinese medicine. Now, coming back to astragalus, is that it helps to raise and tonify qi because it helps to support the spleen, our digestive system, helps us extract those nutrients or the qi from the food, which then gets used to build our qi and our blood. Now, specifically, astragalus is used to tonify a particular type of qi within the body known as the defensive qi or the Wei qi. This defensive qi kind of like coats the outside of the body. And in Western terms, really we've likened it to the immune system. So we start to see that from a Chinese medicine perspective, I really think about it as like astragalus kind of goes in and it supports from the center of the body moving out and helping to provide this defensive qi, which is like a protective coating on the outside of the body, which protects the body from invasion of what Chinese call pathogens. You know, we might think about it as invasions of bacteria and viruses, or, you know, when we're in the cold environment, like people tend to get sick. Astragalus helps to protect the body in that by making it more vital, by making it more robust, and to help build that qi and that energy. Now, from a Western perspective, we see that what it's actually doing is that it actually promotes B cell proliferation, it promotes the production of antibodies, it enhances our cytotoxic T lymphocyte activity, which is helping our T lymphocytes like find and kill infections. It increases our immunoglobulin levels like IgM, IgE. It increases them in the nose like IgA and IgG. It increases like our macrophage numbers and our general white blood cell function. So you can see that it's got this really broad spectrum, immune supportive and building actions, which is, I guess, what the Chinese traditionally were using in their medicine to support the robustness and resilience of the body. But astragalus also has other actions as well. Like it has these antioxidant actions. So specifically, it increases superoxide dismutase and decreases lipid peroxidase activity. Now, simply what that means is it stops our cells from being oxidized. And when our cells get oxidized, they get damaged and they don't function effectively. And there's a high amount of oxidation taking place during an infection because there's inflammation and there's oxidative stress. This is part about what makes us feel fatigued and run down and, you know, achy, and how it compromises our general cellular function. So astragalus comes in and it helps mop up that mess that's taking place from that inflammation and oxidative stress, and it helps boost our immune system activity. So hopefully, without being too confusing, it kind of shows the comparison in a very simplified way of what's happening in Chinese medicine compared to from a Western perspective. Ultimately, the herb is used to increase vitality, to help increase energy levels in a person. And specifically when we've got a person that is, where that person's fatigued and run down because of a immune compromise activity, like a lowered immune system.
And can I just say, I love when these different medical philosophies connect and they really combine, even though they're really different in the way that they, you know, describe the immune system. But essentially, what you've just described with this, you know, traditional Chinese perspective and the Western perspective in the immune support functions, I mean, it just seems like it's really connecting, which I think is just fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, it's a passion of mine of seeing how the two of those, not how the two of those blend, but there's the paradigm that Chinese medicine used to see the body helps provide another lens that you can understand what's taking place within an individual to help, I guess, address where things may be out of balance and help support them get back to health.
And I've also heard about astragalus that you wouldn't want to use in an acute infection. So is that correct?
Yeah, so this is one that is probably worth paying attention to. There's differing opinions even from a Chinese medicine perspective, but essentially because it looks to go in and tonify the body, there is some thought within some schools of Chinese medicine that you don't use it in an acute infection, because essentially in an acute infection, the body is providing a battle between the pathogen and the body itself. And what may happen is if you tonify the body, you may support some schools may say you even may support and tonify the pathogen, which is probably, from my understanding, a bit of a misunderstanding. But what they also think is what it may do is it may help the body adapt to that stress, but not completely remove it. So if you think about the two of them being at a, the levels of the pathogen go up, and so therefore the levels of the immune system go up, and it's waging a war, and there's a battle between the two of those at a bit of a up and down. And what may happen is if you just tonify the body, it may then overcome the challenge of the infection, but it may not remove the infection completely. So from a Western perspective, certainly, and even from a Chinese medicine perspective, it very much depends on the specific diagnosis. So that's why there's some more nuances. So let's just kind of generally say that unless you know what you're doing there, you just avoid it. And for the same reason, from a Western perspective, unless you know exactly what's going on from a Chinese medicine perspective, which wouldn't be the case unless you're a Chinese medicine practitioner, you're best just avoiding it in an acute situation. So I would use echinacea and astragalus in that longer term patient, where they've had an infection for longer term. So we're talking 4-6 weeks. If that infection's been hanging around for that long, I don't mind using astragalus then. However, if someone's come in and say, I just feel like I'm coming down with something, or I've got this infection, it's been there for 1-2 weeks, I would not put them on astragalus. And if they were taking it, I'd advise them to be stopping to take that herb. I'd then move into more of my acute immune support. So like echinacea would be in there. But astragalus, it's better to use after it's been there chronically, so at least 4-6 weeks, and then use that long term, fine to do. If someone does come down with an acute infection, do stop taking it at the time. However, I tend to find if people are taking astragalus, they don't get sick, but it's more to think about when you start prescribing. If they're sick at the time and it's acute, don't prescribe it.
Thanks for that clarification. You know, you've mentioned the word a couple times of adaptogenic. And I want to move on to our next herb, which is, of course, we have ashwagandha. And it's another herb that I absolutely love. And I couldn't live without as a practitioner. And, you know, this herb really just does so much. I find it's great for that wired and tired patient, with that patient that has fatigue, that's just that paralyzing fatigue, but they can't get any sleep at night. And so can you talk about ashwagandha, you know, as an adaptogen and some of the other indications for using this herb?
For sure. It is such a powerful and wonderful adaptogen, isn't it? It's like, I find that ashwagandha is a herb that's gained so much popularity around the world now. It's, you know, I see it traveling the world in drinks, you're in cafes, and it's in teas, and it's just used in everything, because even the whole world's cottoned on to how effective and beneficial this herb is. And as you said, it's for across the board, you know, it's not for someone that's just tired, it's for a person that can be wired and tired, and we can talk about how that works in a second. But essentially, for those that aren't aware, ashwagandha is an Ayurvedic herb, so it comes out of India. Its traditional use dates back to more than 3,000 years, and it's classified as what's known as a rasayana herb. Now, rasayana herbs in Ayurveda are probably similar somewhat to like adaptogens, essentially. And rasayana herbs strengthen resistance of the body and protect it from infectious diseases and degeneration. So ashwagandha is said to provide fresh energy and vigor for a system that's like worn out by constitutional disease. Now, if that doesn't sound like something that everyone just wants to take every day, then I don't know what is. But really what ashwagandha is doing is it's supporting resistance against disease and revitalizing the body. And it's doing this through some of its adaptogenic effects. And so specifically what it does is it stimulates these intracellular proteins, like these proteins within the cells, which strengthen our cells. And they're known as heat shock proteins. And those heat shock proteins, like this is one of the actions that ashwagandha has, those heat shock proteins basically help the cell function more efficiently and become more robust and strong. Like, not to bore or get, you know, bore the audience or go on too much of a tangent, but these proteins are called heat shock proteins because when you shock a cell and put it under heat, the cell produces these proteins to help it survive. And then it can be exposed to the same level of heat next time and greater because it's more robust. So you're doing that to your cells, and that's what happens when you take ashwagandha. And then collectively, that's what those cells do to the individuals. It helps the body become more robust and resilient to stress. Now, one of the reasons why I love ashwagandha is that I find a lot of people in the modern world now are probably working towards a bit more of a depleted state, in the sense that people are worn out, they're tired, especially after the last couple of years. Everyone is, their resistance is becoming compromised to some degree. Now, ashwagandha doesn't work via stimulating properties. It works via nourishing actions. And you started to touch on this. So it really has this nourishing, building, supportive action, like the building action specifically, like it helps to raise red blood cells. It increases hemoglobin. So it's beneficial for literally building the blood. So ashwagandha gets used in cases of things, conditions such as anemia. It's got this like vitalizing, nourishing, building effect. So it gets used for anything across the board from stress disorders such as anxiety or stress or mood disorders, if someone's feeling flat or a little bit depressed, etc., right through to insomnia. It gets used for conditions of the immune system such as like asthma, bronchitis, psoriasis, arthritis, rheumatism. But it also helps by boosting vitality. It actually helps to increase fertility, or helps to decrease infertility in individuals. So it improves sperm health in men, and improves hormone levels in women to help with fertility, improves her egg quality, and helps testosterone levels in men as well. So it's got this real building, nourishing activities for the body across the board. I mean, essentially, I've talked about immune system here. I've talked about the nervous system and stress. We've talked about the reproductive system. This is a herb that is essentially quite useful for people along a lot of different areas of their lifespan. And interestingly, it's, you know, it's really been shown, because of that rasayana nature of it, to be helping to in some ways, you know, you could probably simplify it saying like looking at increasing vitality, because it helps with the performance and function of the individual, certainly as we start to degenerate and we start to become older.
And when we talk about herbs like this, it's like, I just think, who wouldn't want all of these things that you just mentioned with ashwagandha? You know, it's so well studied. It's so versatile. It can be used for so many different clinical indications. Is there a time that you wouldn't use ashwagandha?
It's almost like that, isn't it? Because it's appropriate across the board. It is a really safe herb as well. And so it is, in terms of, you know, when we're formulating, you know, formulated products, like often we'll be working with liquid mixes, so you make that for an individual. But ashwagandha is also a useful herb that gets put in a lot of formulated products that you buy off the shelf, tablets, capsules, because it's got a pretty good safety profile. It doesn't interfere with too many medications. There's not too many conditions that it is compromised in, you know, or contraindicated in. In saying that, there's always herb drug interaction. So if you're listening to this, it's worth speaking to a qualified physician to be making sure that the medications or the condition that you have, that ashwagandha is safe, or that, you know, if it's even the most relevant herb for you. It's probably the main time that it would think about is in conception or in during pregnancy. You know, is that there's differing opinions about the safety of using ashwagandha through different stages of pregnancy. There's probably also times where, in cases of immunosuppressant medication, if someone's taking immunosuppressant medication for a very severe reason, you know, such as an organ transplant, you'd want to be making sure that you're not going to cause any kind of immune disruption from the immune activities of ashwagandha. But really, it is useful across the board that speak to a qualified physician. It's probably easier to look at the times where I really, really use it is in that exhausted, wired, anxious person that's stressed out. They can't sleep often. There's maybe generally some mild immune compromise. They might have anemia, that sort of stressed, wired, tired, debilitated person that just feels like they need a nice warm hug to just kind of build them back up. Like, kind of sometimes, as silly as that may sound, I think that ashwagandha just goes into the nervous system and just feeds that nervous system and helps it like kind of just get back to its resilience and growth again. I also love to use it in preconception care in men because it improves like their sperm parameters, it improves their hormone levels, and in women as well. I'd love to use it as it's pretty much always in a preconception formula. Again, because it's also got these effects on stress. So stress can be affecting fertility as well. So in answer directly to your question, it's useful across the board. Make sure you speak to a physician really in case you're on particular herbs that may be contraindicated. Immunosuppressants are the main one that come to mind. And in later stages of pregnancy, there's some thoughts about whether it's safe or not and different sort of literature based off traditional use there. But it's really quite relevant across the board. And it's often, you know, herbs don't generally work in isolation. While studies show that ashwagandha does work well by itself, it's often a herb that are combined with other herbs. You know, what we've been talking about, maybe with astragalus, or maybe with echinacea, or maybe with other nervines, like St. John's wort is another one I was, you know, love to prescribe and or constantly holding in my clinic for my patients. And it's often combined with St. John's wort and ashwagandha. I find do well together because of the nervine and adaptogenic effects they have.
Perfect. And speaking about St. John's wort, I think this one's a really common herb to maybe go into that box where people just think about St. John's wort and mood, and they forget that this herb is a nervine, and it works, has an effect over the entire nervous system, and it shouldn't just be classified as maybe, you know, an herbal SSRI. So, you know, can you speak to this specifically, you know, St. John's wort, you know, we know that has this indication for maybe some mood disorders, but there's other therapeutic considerations as well, correct?
Thank you so much for bringing that up, Dana. It's like, it's a real bugbear of mine because I love St. John's wort because it is, as you're saying, is so appropriate for so many avenues within the nervous system. But because it works so well for depression and you've got high quality research demonstrating that it's beneficial in mild to moderate depression, and even in higher cases of depression, studies have shown that in severe depression, St. John's Wort is effective. Because of that, and I guess because of the prevalence of depression, St. John's Wort's really just been typecast and dubbed as like an antidepressant and like a natural selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor, or SSRI, which is one of the most common forms of antidepressant medications that's prescribed now. Where St. John's Wort does so much more than that. And like, essentially, when we start to look at, stress disorders, mood disorders is something that I've specialized in. It's a real passion of mine because it's too prevalent within society now. The options that people have are not the best. They have varying degrees of success with, side effects. And so there's a lot that we can do from a herbal medicine perspective and from a natural medicine and functional medicine perspective for individuals suffering from depression. And so when we look at depression, we look at the fact that like the leading hypothesis on depression still at this point in time is what's known as the monoamine hypothesis. This is what dictates that these monoamines, which are particular neurotransmitters that we have within our brain, are deficient and imbalanced, and this is what's causing the mood disorder, the depression. So these monoamines are what people will have heard of as serotonin, dopamine, and norepinephrine. Now, yes, St. John's Wort does help and has been shown to increase levels of these neurotransmitters. Specifically, serotonin is the one that gets a lot of attention, but it's also been shown to increase norepinephrine and dopamine. But the whole problem that's going on in depression is broader than neurotransmitters. And there's a developing theory in mental health now that is showing that these neurotransmitters are actually just deficient or imbalanced in particular regions of the brain, more because we have inflammation within the brain. Now, inflammation anywhere in the body is never a great thing. When it's taking place in your brain, it's certainly not a good thing. It causes neurotoxicity, which is neuronal death. We start to get damage of the neurons, and we start to get a change. And studies show that we actually have negative remodeling of the brain, meaning that we start to actually have areas of our brain tissue that starts to die off and starts to shrink. We therefore don't have the same level of activity in that brain. Now, because of that, it is thought in this theory of inflammation and central inflammation within the brain causing mood disorders such as depression, that that's then why we see changes in these neurotransmitters. Now, really where this is going in this sort of new hypothesis is what we need to be doing is we need to be helping to decrease inflammation within the brain, and we need to be helping to grow new neurons within the brain, and we need to help to be showing to increase the brain activity in particular regions. So we're offsetting the damage that's taken place. Now, for those that are just hearing this the first time, this may sound far out there. This may sound a little bit extreme and a little bit scary. It probably does sound a bit like that, and it probably is, but it's the sheer fact of what's taking place. And there's plenty of research that's actually demonstrating this, and MRI scans that show that this is what's taking place within the brain, and studies that are showing that if we offset this inflammation, and what happens is you need to decrease the inflammation, you need to decrease the neurotoxicity. Now, that neurotoxicity comes because we have a combination of another neurotransmitter, glutamate, in the brain. Glutamate's necessary to fire neuronal activity. It's neuroexcitatory. It stimulates our neurons. However, we get too much of it in inflammation, and we have too much oxidative stress, and we have a perfect storm. Oxidative stress, glutamate, this neuroexcitation, and inflammation. And you get a change in the brain structure. Now, why am I going on this huge tangent for St. John's Wort, you might be thinking? Because St. John's Wort, yes, it changes our monoamines, serotonin, norepinephrine, and dopamine, but they're likely changed because we have inflammation within the brain. So does St. John's Wort help to decrease the neurotoxicity? Does St. John's Wort help to decrease the neuroinflammation? Does St. John's Wort help to decrease the glutamate, which is causing the problems within the physical brain structure, which is then the consequence we're getting changes in our neurotransmitters? Yes, it does. Yes, St. John's Wort has been shown to help for allowing beneficial neuronal remodeling, so helping the brain regrow, which it will do if we take away that neuroinflammation, neurotoxicity, and the glutamate. Specifically, St. John's Wort has done this because it helps to increase neurotrophic factors, which is what's known as to help to think about them as fertilizer for your brain. The main one is known as BDNF, brain-derived neurotrophic factor. St. John's Wort has been shown to increase brain-derived neurotrophic factor. This is what we're more interested in when we're looking at helping in depression, because that's helping the brain remodel. We want to decrease the inflammation and the neurotoxicity and increase the neurotrophic factors. And that's what St. John's does. So, I mean, in some ways it might be potato, potato. I mean, it's helping to improve the mood, but it's again, you know, I guess it's the theme of how I like to sort of see things, the devil's in the detail. How is it doing that? And it's doing that because it's helping the brain stopping that toxic environment that's taking place and helping it regenerate, not just looking at serotonin. Now, I'd probably just also need to say that, interestingly, like, because if someone's putting this together and they're hearing this for the first time, or they may have heard this as well, okay, what about pharmaceutical antidepressants? How come they do work if they're working on our monoamines, our serotonin, our dopamine, noradrenaline? Interestingly, pharmaceutical antidepressants increase brain-derived neurotrophic factor as well. And you see an increase in BDNF sooner than you see an increase in serotonin, which tends to correlate with symptom changes in someone on antidepressants. The problem is with pharmaceutical antidepressants, very useful in situations, do not get me wrong. However, sometimes in some individuals, they don't agree. They cause side effects. They don't get a response rate. You get about a 30% response rate from pharmaceutical antidepressants. So about 70% of people out there are not getting benefit. So we need other options. St. John's Wort provides an option for that. In saying that, well, it provides mechanisms that could support what's taking place in an individual with depression. In saying that, something that's probably well known is that you want to be careful combining St. John's Wort with a pharmaceutical antidepressant, because both of them are working in their own different ways to increase serotonin levels. It's not all it's doing, as I've just explained, but as a side effect, essentially, serotonin levels can increase. If you have two higher levels of serotonin, you can get what's known as serotonin syndrome, where people get like photosensitivity, like sensitivity to light, start to get headaches, they feel unwell. It's not a very nice condition. It's quite extreme. And so you need to be careful about taking St. John's Wort if you are on pharmaceutical antidepressants. But there's certainly, in individuals who aren't on antidepressants, a lot of good evidence of St. John's Wort being effective for mood, but also for a variety of other things. And I guess to kind of move on and to get to your next point is that it is a nervine that traditionally was used for supporting the entire nervous system. So this includes things such as neuroses and hysteria, neuralgia and sciatica. Like, traditionally, from a Western medicine perspective, St. John's Wort is used really well for the person that's got like a sensitivity of the nervous system. Now, what I mean by that is a patient that has very sensitive senses. So the person that, when they're stressed out, sounds can be very irritating. Or I see this a lot in children where they're very sensitive to different fabrics and their skin, and they kind of may develop rashes, or like they may be wearing wool, different fabrics, and it causes like real irritation to the skin. This person with those heightened senses, the person that may be just sort of generally a little bit more sensitive, St. John's Wort does really well to calm things down. Now, on more of a neurological perspective, you'll also see that in that neuralgia and, you know, neuropathic pain. So whether that's like sciatica or carpal tunnel, anyone who's experiencing, or even post shingles, rashes and sensitivities and pains, St. John's Wort is really effective there. And especially in the case of something like after shingles or herpes zoster, it's a virus, and St. John's has, you know, really good, strong antiviral properties. So another place completely different that I actually use St. John's Wort is combining it with echinacea and astragalus in that post-viral conditions. So a person that comes in and they may have had a virus, it may have been like Epstein-Barr, or it may have been, you know, a long-standing virus, and they've got like that long, tired, you know, feeling unwell. Echinacea, astragalus, and echinacea is what I use. And St. John's Wort here, more for its antiviral aspects than its nervine aspects there.
And thank you so much for mentioning those antiviral properties. I've used it successfully, you know, just like you mentioned, shingles, that post-herpetic neuralgia. You know, I get wonderful results with St. John's wort. I did just want to ask you as well, what dosing should we be looking at if we are going back to, you know, some of those, that depression, you know, you talked about that additional kind of hypothesis, which is just fascinating. But what dosing, you know, might we be looking at for St. John's wort in those indications?
Yeah, so, I mean, by a large standout, the main reason why you'd be prescribing St. John's wort in clinic is for those nervine properties. So those mood disorders, I'm focused a lot on depression, but anxiety, you've got similar sort of physiological pathways or pathophysiology taking place. And anxiety is another area where I'd be using St. John's wort, or just the same as you may be getting mood disorders in menopausal, you know, in that menopausal transition, St. John's wort works really effectively there. Now, the dosing across the board for all of those is the same kind of dosing. You're looking around about 3.5 to 6 grams a day of good quality St. John's wort. Now, the reason why I say good quality St. John's wort is if you want to get those actions where I was talking about of supporting the monoamines, so the serotonin, norepinephrine, dopamine, if you want to get those actions of raising brain-derived neurotrophic factor, the neuro anti-inflammatory and anti-neurotoxic effects in the brain, you need the constituents within St. John's wort of hyperferrin and hypericin. And you're getting good levels of hypericin in a good quality St. John's extract, where in a lower St. John's extract, you won't get hypericin. At 3.5 to 6 grams a day, 2 to 4 weeks, I generally start to see improvements in people.
Wow, Lawrence, thank you so much. You are just a wealth of information. Thanks for joining us today, and we really hope to see you again soon.
Oh, thanks so much for having me again, Dana. It's great to chat.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to the Medicinal Herbs podcast from Holistic Matters. HolisticMatters.com is powered by Standard Process, a nutritional supplement company family-owned and operated for over 90 years. For more nutrition education, including our medicinal herbs database, go to HolisticMatters.com. That's holistic with a W.